this city won't ever die. Just as long as the heart be strong, like a second line stepping high, reason till is ruling long. Chantilly to the Lucaray, low and nice, such a city of town. Singing Giacomo Pinani, this city won't ever drown.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming up next is Health Watch. Today, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein about gaining ground. Their feature-length documentary film telling the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practices. And at 11:30, you will want to stay tuned to hear a new report on the nation's prison population as host Doug McVeigh interviews Mark Mayer of the Sentencing Project and Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for your community radio station. If you are not yet a member, you know, you can still become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guests are filmmakers Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. Elaine and Barbara have been creating film and radio documentaries for over 35 years. Their award-winning work has been broadcast on public television and radio, screened at international film festivals, and distributed through broad grassroots networks. Barbara is also host of Locus Focus here on KBOO every Monday morning. Barbara and Elaine are here today on Health Watch to talk about their new documentary, Gaining Ground, which tells the stories of two rural farms in Oregon and one urban inner-city farm in Richmond, California. Stories that engage questions of health and nutrition, ecology and corporate accountability, issues of race, class, and gender, all while following some of the most inspirational people who, despite being confronted with skepticism, sometimes even within their own families, are not only dreaming of a different model of food and food justice, a different model of community and community transformation, a different way of creating opportunity in places with very little, but are creating these things on the ground right now, today. Welcome to Health Watch, Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein.
Thanks.
Well, let's start out with how you both decided on the locales. Was that an obvious choice at the beginning, these two rural farms and the inner city farm that you chose in Oregon and California?
We found Vicki at SunGold, Vicki and Chris, her son, at SunGold Farms fairly easily, but we did a lot of filming and searching around to try and find our people. Mm-hmm. And Barbara did most of the locating of these wonderful people.
Actually, after we chose these three farms, after interviewing people, we must have interviewed about 15 different farms and urban agriculture programs. It hit me one day. We found a large farm that's transitioning growing grass seed and wheat, which is about the furthest from food, or this is commodity wheat, to growing local grains, which is a really important part of having a sustainable, viable local food system. And then we had the medium-sized farm, which is SunGold Farm in Bearboard, Oregon, which was transitioning or had already transitioned from being a commodity dairy to growing 100 varieties of fruits and vegetables for local markets, and they do all direct marketing through CSA and farmers markets. And then the hyper-local level of an urban agriculture program that was growing food for a community in Richmond, California, which is a classic food desert. I mean, they have no good food that they have access to anywhere within walking or even close driving distance. So it was kind of serendipity the way it happened. But we basically found the farms through Vicki, I'd actually met Chris Hurdle several years ago at the Interstate Farmers Market, which no longer exists, when I was doing another radio documentary about urban farming, and thought they would grow some of the best produce I'd ever eaten. And we ran into Vicki at an event that Friends and Family Farmers sponsors every year or every other year, Lobby Day at the State Capitol here in Salem. And there's a little farmers market that's set up in the rotunda of the State Capitol. And there we met Vicki Hurdle and Chris. And Elaine was very much taken with Vicki. She was very articulate. We knew that she was going to have to be in the film. You want to talk about somehow we met the other people?
Well, I think we heard about Willow Coberly, Stalford Seed Farms, and Green Willow Grains, Willow Coberly and Harry Stalford, first from Harry McCormick, who started Oregon Tilth, and they weren't in the film yet. And then it was a little luck. We had one interview with Willow, and I wasn't sure. And then we asked to also interview Harry, the farmer, who's a grass seed farmer, who was anti-organic growing anything in the valley. I was a little afraid of him, but they were great. I mean, when somebody is really good on camera, honest, and they can, it's got to do with some ability to really open themselves up, and you can empathize with them. And they were very strong. And then Barbara located, we wanted to do an inner city, and Barbara located about Doria Robinson. And one conversation, it was obvious this woman is brilliant and articulate, and she led us in to their world, which is basically a community of color with Chevron Refinery over their town in Richmond, California. And they're growing organic produce and teaching the kids and in the schools.
Well, it really is this great compare and contrast of locations, but what really makes the movie Gaining Ground entertaining and engrossing film are the personalities. And I just, strangely, even though at the beginning I felt this sort of aversion to Harry, the grass seed farmer, he grew to be the crucial character in a lot of ways in the film. And part of it is he represents at the beginning something that I didn't know, that how little of food is actually grown in the Willamette Valley. So you were talking about grass seed for golf courses or wheat that apparently is mostly exported to China for noodles. And he was the sort of the epitome of this sort of farmer with conventional high input fertilizer, lots of pesticides, and super skeptical. And skepticism seems to be a major theme in this movie that's getting overcome in both Richmond and in Oregon. But tell us a little bit about the dynamic he has with his wife and what she wants and how he drags his heels at every little move that she wants to make on the farm.
Well, Harry is a stubborn, he's kind of cliche, stubborn farmer. We did it last year, so we have to do it next year. And he, even though his wife is a very strong personality, but she was like 15 years or 13 years trying to get him to change. And she finally asked Harry McCormick to help her talk Harry into it. And he sort of did it. And he transforms over the period of the film. I mean, we filmed for at least 4 years following these stories.
Yeah, watching his trajectory is really remarkable.
Well, actually, when we first interviewed Willow, and we interviewed Willow and her mother back in November of 2011, and they were talking about Harry like he was a bit of an ogre. He was like really a problem in terms of trying to get him to go along with what they were wanting to do. And he was, in the beginning of the film, Willow says, he offered me 11 acres on a 10,000 acre farm to start our experiment, with this wonderful expression she has, like sort of a sardonic expression. But so it was still kind of an issue. And Harry McCormick had described him like this big guy. Harry McCormick is a little guy. And Harry Stalford is a big guy. And the way that Harry McCormick described Harry Stalford, we thought, oh, he's going to be this cliche grass seed farmer, and he's going to be the villain in the film. He's the person we're trying to overcome. And actually, weren't so much when we met Willow, we realized, no, he's not going to be the villain, but certainly a challenge. And one thing is interesting, that he and Elaine hit it off immediately. And I think that Harry Stalford is like a wannabe filmmaker. So we called him Martin Scorsese, and he gave us ideas for shots, actually. And he drove us around in his flatbed truck, driving all around the roads around their farm, shooting scenes of the fields and stuff. And he was so cooperative and really engaged in the whole filmmaking process. And I think we caught him at this really interesting moment where he was starting to really get the power of growing organic food and understanding that this was really important for the community, important for the world, and also important for them in order to stay in business, because grass seed and commodity wheat is a really hard way to earn a living.
Well, he was very ambivalent. He possibly still is. I mean, they make their main money through grass seed and through Asian wheat, and but the organics has taken off incredibly, and they're doing very, very well.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to filmmakers Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein about their latest food documentary, Gaining Ground. Well, another thing that was interesting that it relates to this particular farm and the other Oregon farm is the bread company that reads this article about people who are trying to eat only within 100 food that's only grown within 100 miles of their house, and realizing that in order to do so in the Pacific Northwest or in the Willamette Valley, they had to give up bread and give up beans, that these two crops were pretty absent from the local economy, and that inspired a bread company to then look into, can we grow wheat in the Willamette Valley? And Harry, at the beginning, having skepticism about whether that was possible.
Well, that's a whole thing, because, I mean, they used to grow hard red wheat, which is the wheat that has high protein that you would use for bread. It used to be grown here in the Willamette Valley, probably up until World War II. And then the farming economy here really started shifting from growing food for local consumption for local canneries to growing mostly non-food, grass seed, and then growing wheat for export. And the wheat that they grow for export is soft white winter wheat. And Willow says it's probably true that this Willamette Valley is not the best place in the world to grow hard red wheat. Montana's probably got a better climate for it. But she was lucked upon these seeds that had been developed at Davis, University of California, Davis, by this person who was on her way out and happened to have this whole stock of seeds that she developed for the particular climate of the Willamette Valley. So Willow got a hold of these seeds and worked on, they planted the first year's crop, and they lost a lot, but they culled the seeds of the plants that survived, and they replanted those, and within a couple of seasons, they were having really successful yields. And that's how you adapt seeds to your local climate. So I think that is a real indication of, you know, just the kind of tenacity it takes to figure out how to do something that they say you can't do. And certainly the Oregon State University's Extension Service and their whole agriculture school is like, oh, you can't do this.
Well, it's also interesting to learn how vital farmers markets and CSAs are to these farmers, that there used to be an infrastructure for local food, storage for wheat, canneries, and now there's no infrastructure. So they really do rely as a lifeline for farmers markets and CSA subscriptions to keep the local food organic economy alive.
Well, that's certainly true for SunGold. SunGold, who is growing, well, they were dairymen. They got like a certain amount of money for their milk, and they had no control over it. They weren't even sure they could cover their forage bills for the cows, because it was some corporation somewhere deciding what they, you know, deserved. I was told by Vicky the price hasn't gone up in, I don't know, 20 years?
Since 1972.
Long time. Anyway, and so they were just scraping by, but they'd done it generation after generation. This is a fifth generation farm. And when they were put out of business by DEQ, the cows being too close to the water, and they're changing their rules, and they started growing vegetables, they discovered that they could actually make a really decent living, or for them a decent, you know, they actually could go 2 weeks to California in the winter time, or something like that. And for them, CSA and farmers markets is the lifeblood of their distribution.
And Stalford Seed Farms, Green Willow Grains, has done some distribution through farmers markets. They also work, actually, Willow, along with the Willamette Seed and Grain, or Bean and Seed, I remember quite remember the name of that organization, but there's a group of people, farmers, in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I think it's the Willamette Valley Bean and Seed Project. And they started a thing every year called Fill Your Pantry, and they had it in Shedd, Oregon, which is about 6 miles south of Tangent, where Stafford Seed Farms is located, and where farmers bring in basically storage crops for the winter, and people go and they fill their pantry with potatoes and onions and garlic and all kinds of stuff. And there's going to be, the movement is spread, and now there's going to be a Fill Your Pantry, I think, next month. That's going to be held somewhere here in Portland. The Friends of Family Farmers is organizing. So this is moving the farmers market and CSA model further to where you're encouraging people to do their own storage, basically, become their own store.
Right. That's really interesting. Well, let's switch to Richmond, California. You'd mentioned that Richmond is near the Chevron refinery. It's near San Quentin Prison. It's an inner city, very different than these rural farms in Oregon. Tell us about Doria Robinson. What's she all about, and what was she up against when she started envisioning returning to her community after going elsewhere for school and starting an edible forest in an urban garden?
Well, Doria has this amazing education that she happened to she worked her way through school. She worked her way through high school and through college. She's, you know, the education they were giving in Richmond, California was like, let her drive by. She just had it, because it's a violent neighborhood and underserved and just hard, you know. And then the refinery is literally right above their town, and Chevron doesn't really take care of them. So anyway, so she went to this really good high school called Maybeck in Berkeley, and then they gave her a scholarship to Hampshire, and she came back with those skills, and she was born right there in Richmond, and her family's there. And she said, this is the front line, and we've got to hold it. And she didn't start Urban Tilth, but when she took over about 7 years ago, something like that, she does that model of trying to not just, food is a vehicle for them. She wants to feed her community. It's organic, and it's really free, or what they can afford. But she wants to empower the kids. And she teaches in the school how to grow your own food and teaches them leadership skills. They have a serious responsibility when they come in. They run that program, and they can fail. And she's just a really brilliant leader. She understands what it takes, the kind of support and the kind of belief in these kids. And they're amazing. Her staff is amazing.
I loved watching her, and also watching her students or people coming up in the program who are now taking on responsibility. It was really amazing to watch them.
Well, there's two young people that we focus on. I mean, we could have focused on a number of them, because there's quite a few of our staff who are all in their 20s. She calls them kids. Doria just recently turned 40. So she's a kid. But they are just really inspiring young people. And Tanya Polito and Sherman Dean are the two that we focus on. And Tanya's story is interesting in a way, a little bit reminiscent of Doria's, in that she decided to go to the University of California, Berkeley. And she, to her amazement, got in. And she just graduated last year. And her goal was to use the skills and the credibility that she gets from having a BA from Cal to help the community and to be able to write grants and be able to speak to power, basically. And when she talks, you sort of see another Doria forming, because I mean, she uses a lot of the same language that Doria has, and you can really see how Doria has taught her. But she's also going off in her own direction and being her own person, and it's wonderful to see that.
Well, you mentioned that Richmond is a food desert, that there's not a lot of good access to food. There's a lot of fast food restaurants, a lot of liquor stores, and a lot of these people getting involved in the urban tilth, their parents aren't familiar with the foods that they're learning to grow and cook themselves. So often the education's happening the other way in the generations, where someone empowered in the urban tilth is getting access to new knowledge and then sharing it with their parents.
Well, that's true. It's also There is a large Central American migrant population, as well as the African Americans coming, like I think Doris, Louisiana, her people came from Louisiana. They know how to grow foods, and they've forgotten it. They come into this neighborhood with no resources, and they don't see their own worth. So it's not just the kids learning something, maybe reminding the parents, you know, that to cook greens or to get back in touch with their culture. There's a lot of coming back in all of the stories where they've left, you know, including, you know, Vicky's children couldn't be farmers because they were so poor running the milk farm and then being put out of business, and they come back. There's a lot of, you know, re-embracing and generational, you know, coming back around, mm-hmm. and the opposite of what Big Ag has been doing to our food system forever.
And was there any challenges around establishing trust or rapport or access when going to Richmond as outsiders of the from the community?
Well, I think that some of it was this first conversation I had with Dory over the phone. I actually saw a quote from her in an article that I was reading about urban agriculture online. I was just kind of doing research on urban ag at that time, thinking that was going to be an important focus of the film. And this quote was great, and so I Googled urban tilth, and I got a phone number, and I emailed her. She emailed me right back, said, let's talk. I call her. She's right there. And as we're talking, I think we felt like we were really sharing the same values. And so that was the beginning of trust. When we got there, I will say that Elaine and I were really nervous. I've been through Richmond a lot. I used to live in the Bay Area very briefly. And Richmond was the place you went through from Berkeley to get to the beach. And it was kind of not a place anybody I knew was interested in getting to know. So I had, and I thought of it just being like Chevron pollution and stuff like that. And also it had quite a reputation for being a pretty dangerous neighborhood. So we had all of our equipment and we were nervous about it, but urban tilth kind of just surrounded us. I mean, the first time we went to shoot, one of the guys came up to us and said, basically stood there with us, kind of chaperoning us and telling us, don't go over there, you're cool over here. So when we started filming around the town, we would get volunteers from Urban Tilth to basically be our tour guide. Mm. And particularly Sherman was the person who went with us. And he knew everybody in town, and it was just great. And it actually drew people to us because of his presence and his personality. And so we did that for the first few shoots. And then actually it was after the fire in 2012 when the Chevron refinery had this big fire. We're thinking we're going to be having the film finished by then, and instead it just opened up a whole new chapter of the story. And we did a lot of filming after that, and at one point we asked Doria if she thought it was okay for us to just go off on our own, because we really knew our way around Richmond at that point and felt comfortable in a lot of the communities. And she said, it's up to you. You know, it's like the whole thing was up to us all along. It's like when we had our own comfort level, then we're cool and we won't be the same targets. Also, in the 3 years that we've been filming, the violence had really gone way, way down. And there had been a couple drive-bys the first time we went to shoot there, just a week before. By the time after the fire, it was the crime level was going down there as it was going up in the rest of the Bay Area. So it was actually, in reality, a much safer place to work as well.
Mm. The other thing is that as soon as we interviewed Doria, who's African-American, she talked to us. I felt like she was letting us into her reality. And that was so wonderful, and it only deepened. I mean, I think we went down there about 7 times. We drove down and filmed. And, you know, she became, as it's true with these kind of films where you take a long time and you don't run in and run out, and you form a relationship and more trust.
Well, you mentioned the refinery fire in Richmond, and I think something that really deepens the film is we see the success of the transition to organics in Oregon, and we see all of these young people in Richmond getting engaged in the greenway and in the edible forest in a way that's pretty amazing, actually. And yet there's still ongoing struggles. So obviously in Richmond they have some struggles that are community focused, maybe some vandalism or other things going on in the farm. But then there are things that are outside of their control, like the refinery fire, which ruined an entire year's worth of crops. And then in parallel in Oregon, the contamination of GMO in the fields, which Asia then decided not to buy Oregon wheat, which drove down all the prices for conventional wheat for farmers who had nothing to do with the contamination or weren't even in that part of Oregon. So these, tell us a little bit about that shift in tone in the movie and how we go up, we see this building, and then we also see the reality that there's big powers that seem to also have undue influence on people who are community organizing.
Well, they're there. Our corporations are there. Monsanto is there, Chevron is there, all the other corporations that are real. And we knew we weren't going to have like a happy ending and we all drive into the sunset. And it's left and the threat's still there. Monsanto is still there. Chevron acted the way that they acted the last time. They had, you know, got a very bad safety record. They don't care about the population, or it appears. So that's always been there. And actually, Chevron wasn't mentioned to us until after the fire. So it was sort of like the elephant in the, you know, they talked about other things and other challenges, but it wasn't even mentioned until after the fires that there's this thing a block away that has accidents all the time. You know, so it, I don't remember where I'm going from here, but
that's okay. Well,
yeah.
Actually, for us, it was a real challenge when the fire happened. We'd gone down the day before the fire to be shooting all week, and we're going to be shooting. They have an apprenticeship program for high school students every summer, and it was going to be the final week in celebration, and we were going to shoot that, and it was going to be the end of the film. And the night before we were supposed to do our first interview with Doria, we're sitting at our friend's house in Berkeley about to have dinner, and my friend comes in and says, the Richmond Chevron refinery is on fire. Didn't have much dinner. We spent most of the time. Actually, Elaine was filming the TV screen to get the, and it was very good footage to get, and we were able to get permission to use it. But it totally, of course, transformed our week there and
their lives.
And their lives and the shape of the film. And interestingly, one of the guys in Urban Tilth came up to me the day after the fire. They're having this press conference demonstration in front of City Hall in Richmond, and Doria asked us to come film it, so we were there. He comes up to us and says, well, this certainly is going to give your story more drama. And it's, this is,
it does.
Yeah. And I was something, I didn't want to say that. I thought that's really kind of insensitive and callous and
right.
opportunistic. I mean, it's not, this isn't good for us. It isn't good for anybody. But the reality of it is it really heightened the issues that we were trying to show all along, both with that and then with the GMO wheat discovery in Eastern Oregon, that it was one thing to have people talking in the abstract about big ag and big oil. It's a whole different thing when suddenly those stories hit on a personal level. So I don't want to use the word fortunate because it's pretty insensitive. But I think that it gave the film a power that it wouldn't have had if those two events hadn't happened.
Well, part of me feels like, you know, being fortunate, being in that place, the moment that fire happened, and it was all obviously serendipity, if you want to call it serendipity. But, and at first I was very upset. I was like, I want this to be a positive film. I'm going around and whining. And it was, I just feel like it was meant to be. That story was meant to be told, and we fortunately were there at the moment that happened.
I still think it is a positive film. Like, I believe that somehow it's more of a deep and sort of real positive rather than it's not just a pie in the sky. It's showing you the real reality, but it's also really projects I think a vision in both of these places of what could happen, particularly if communities are able to push back against some of these corporate influences.
Well, I think it's inspiring. I think what Doria is doing is inspiring no matter what her obstacles. And the same thing with the Harry and Willow and Vicky at Sungold. It's like they're all like, it's this personal initiative and being willing to try and feed your community healthy local food and dealing with whatever, you know, the obstacles are as they are there. There are many.
And we didn't even touch on many of the little things. Like, I know Vicky and her family was very wary of Portland, even fearful of coming into Portland. And we think of like Portlanders getting to know their farmers, but we also don't think that maybe there's some apprehension the other way around also, and that there's this new way of building community. And then the brief touches you have in the film around returning ecology with animals and birds that come to farms that are more diverse and responsibly
Actually, as we are working on the soundtrack in the last few weeks, it makes me realize how much bird life has returned to the Richmond Greenway because of all the gardening, because we have so many birds on the soundtrack when we're recording in Richmond. So it's not just the farms in rural Oregon where they've really had a return of nature through basically agroecology, but it's also happening in the inner city as well.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's let our listeners know when the film is airing and if there's a way on the website they can find out about it if they're not in Portland.
Well, we're going to be screening out a week from Wednesday, September 30th and October 1st at the Cinema 21 at 616 Northwest 21st. The show starts at 7 o'clock. There'll be a question and answer panel after the show with Elaine and me and many of the farmers, including Dory Robinson and some urban till staff who are coming up from Richmond for the Wednesday night screening. And then Thursday, there'll be another screening. You can go to our website, which is www.mediaprojectonline.org, and there's a lot of information there.
Well, I've been telling everybody about the film. I hope people go. So thank you for being on Health Watch today.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much.
We are talking today to Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein about their latest film, Gaining Ground. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
Buffalo herd, you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. But you can be happy if you've mind to.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, hosted Wednesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at Bison Coffee House in Portland. The event will feature stories and songs about the last wild buffalo and information about the ongoing struggle to protect them. That's the Buffalo Field Campaign 2015 Roadshow, Wednesday, September 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Bison Coffee House, 3941 Northeast Cully Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.